Welcome to Siemens Innovation in the Classroom podcast series. I'm your host, Dora Smith. Listen to hear some of the brightest minds in engineering education share insights and best practices to empower the next generation of digital talent. In this podcast, I interview McMaster University's Dean Puri on how the school is disrupting curricula to improve engineering education. Hear how this leading academic institution develops robot-proof graduates through disruptive innovation in and out of the classroom that closes the skills gap and strengthens graduate employability. So great. Welcome to Siemens Realizing Innovation in the Classroom podcast series with your host, Dora Smith. And today I'm joined by a very special guest, the Dean of the Faculty of Engineering at McMaster University, Ishwar Puri. Welcome, Ishwar.
Well, thank you so much, Dora. This is an absolute pleasure. I look forward to speaking with you about the kinds of things that both you and I are interested in, innovation, employability, and how we can move the higher education classroom into a more contemporary setting.
Yeah, I think this is going to be a good discussion. Maybe just for background, Ishwar, could you give our listeners a little bit of information on yourself? You know, really, what made you pursue engineering as a degree and really choose academia as your profession?
I was afraid you were going to ask me that question, Dora, because because I'm the accidental engineer. I grew up in the Indias, which was an India centered in post-colonial times, where there was lack of opportunity. And in that setting, there wasn't a social security net. And so employability was a big factor for parents. I also grew up in a culture where parents had a big influence on children. I actually wanted to write poetry and be a philosopher. And the true story is that my mother, in true Indian fashion, went on a hunger strike. She didn't eat for 2 weeks. And she said, well, you're going to be unemployed and you're going to be sort of living off your father's earnings and my earnings. And we'd like the situation to be reversed. And so it was through a confluence of factors that I was persuaded to enter the engineering undergraduate degree program at the University of Delhi in Delhi, India. When I entered the program, I was like the lackadaisical student. I was more interested in writing poetry. I was a pamphleteer in the sense that I got together with people and we wrote articles. And in those days, we didn't print them. We would sort of, you know, run them off these machines. After producing typewritten stencils, I was on the debate team and so on. But I found that I did well in the subjects that I was taught in. And I did well, not because I had a profound understanding of them, but because I was able to retain the material and regurgitate it. And so after my first year, I got a bit competitive because I thought, whoa, you've done well, Puri. Now you've got to keep it up. And so in the subsequent years, I started applying myself more. But I wouldn't say that I was convinced of the value of engineering simply because I was in a classroom. I was told things. I was good at math. I could solve predefined problems. You know, I could get marks or grades and do rather well. So after I got my engineering degree, there was a fork in the road. And the fork in the road was get a job. And I had a few offers based on the marks that I had and based on some of the personal characteristics, I think, that I had gained through my education or through my upbringing. Or I could go into management school. So I went to a management school where they taught case studies. It was business management. I was going to study for an MBA, but I got bored after 2 months and decided to leave that. And at that time, there was no internet. And because there was no internet, one actually had to go to libraries. And I went to the American Library in New Delhi, India, found the furthest place I could find in the United States. It wasn't in Hawaii. That, you know, lack of geographical knowledge at that time. It was San Diego. I applied to the University of California, San Diego, and I wound up there doing a PhD. It was only when I was doing my PhD that I began doing research, and research is problem solving. It's not so much regurgitating information, retaining information, that I really became interested in engineering. that you take a real-world problem and you try to create a real-world solution that has a real-world impact in some way. And the problem that I focused on was about flames. Why do they ignite? Why do they extinguish? And the real-world problem there was twofold. One was in internal combustion engines and gas turbines. So if you were on a plane and if you that had a gas turbine or there was an internal combustion engine, you wouldn't want the flame to go out because the engine would fail and that would be catastrophic. And later on, the real-world problem was space station fire safety. You know, if there's a space station, fires in space behave very differently from fires in the terrestrial environment because there's no gravity in space. And so in the Earth's environment, fires rise upwards because of something called buoyancy. Lighter gases rise. But in space where there's no buoyancy, how would fires behave? And some of the work I did during those years contributed to an understanding of flame extinction, space station fire safety, which was later funded by NASA. And so that's really how I got interested in engineering. So I'm unlike most role models, I would say. I really became interested in engineering in my late 20s, I would think. And it was due to serendipity that somebody taught me that if I was presented with real-world problems that would have real-world solutions and real-world impact, well, that would be a pretty good gig.
So I hope you're not telling me that I need to go on a hunger strike if I want to get my sons interested in engineering. But we thank your mom for getting you inspired to start that journey. And it sounds like it's been quite an interesting one.
Oh, it has. And the employability hasn't been half bad either, Dora.
Well, speaking of real-world problems and looking for solutions to those and impactful solutions, I was intrigued by an article I found when I was Googling your name that was recently in the Globe and Mail called How the University Can Save Itself from Itself. And so I'd like you to comment on that, but I want to read a quote from that article because I thought it was very well done. It speaks to your love of poetry and writing. It says, quote, "The competitive advantage of the university or college is its diversity of thought under one roof. You get the medieval panorama of Chaucer, the richness of indigenous studies, the intricacies of venture funding and quantum physics, and the potential for putting young minds together. No other institution offers such a powerful preparation for life. We have to flex this muscle of diverse thought by breaking down barriers between disciplines and faculties." So I ask you to comment on that and share how you flex your muscles and, you know, maybe share a little bit about what a day is like in the life of a dean like yourself.
Well, thank you for asking that question. I can see why you're so successful, Dora. You don't ask the easy questions. So let me reflect upon what you just asked. That article was deliberately written in order to address your question. I would have to take us back 800 years. The current version of the Western University is 800 years old, including its structures of self-governance, organization, tenure, and so on and so forth. The original university had a great need to offset outside interference. It did not desire interference from the king, the prince, or the pope, because it wanted to pursue thought in an academic and free manner. So the original conception of the university created these structures within the university where outside interference was often taken as an infection, and the university infrastructure, its governance procedures, its reliance on mechanisms to enhance academic freedom, such as tenure and so on, were the antibodies that would counter the infection. We're now 800 years down the road, and the original conception of the university has set us up very well. But what it's done is there's a lack of agility. Universities are not agile. We're living in an era where there is change, very rapid change, and sometimes people say exponential change. And there's a lot of hyperbole about the adjectives that are ascribed to change. So suffice it to say that we live in changing times, but the ability of the university to really respond to those changing times is limited in some ways by its deliberative infrastructure. Now, the deliberative infrastructure is not bad, but the deliberative infrastructure, if it is not tackled in the right kind of way, or if it is not utilized in the right kind of way, can produce setbacks to agility, as we see in many universities around the world. The second thing is that, at least over the last century or so, with the very rapid explosion of knowledge, we've become very super specialized. And so what used to be general disciplines, so in the 800-year-old university, or even if you go back 2,000 years ago to, let's say, Socrates or Confucius, if you go back a couple of millennia ago, disciples came together and they talked in groups. And the whole idea was that everybody was a generalist, but they were also a specialist. But we've become so super specialized now that universities have now organized themselves into silos. What the future really needs is now a breakdown of those silos. Engineers have become very specialized. I mean, software engineers know a heck of a lot about software engineering. But really, to tackle change, one must have a profound knowledge of humanity, humanism, and human beings. We also need to make our students robot-proof, AI-proof, machine learning-proof. Because tomorrow, many jobs could be taken on by artificial intelligence, making today's engineering jobs, for instance, redundant. The only way we can offset that kind of change or that kind of disruption in employability is by having our students understand humans. And I go back to what excited me about engineering, is to go back and show students ways of considering real-world problems that have real-world clients who require real-world solutions. So we've got to imbue whatever we do in education with a profound kind of design thinking or dynamic design thinking that is going to make our graduates relevant in the future. And that's what the spirit of that article was, saving the university by itself, from itself, which is that universities must not be silos. Let's leverage the real disciplinary competencies that we have, the richness of academic learning that we have, the richness of academic knowledge that we have in the humanities, in the arts, in the professional disciplines like business and engineering, the health sciences, the social sciences. We need to merge them to produce tomorrow's graduates, because those graduates have to know how to design and create. Those graduates have to know how to work in multidisciplinary teams. All the simple problems have been solved. We are now faced with wicked problems like climate change, the opioid crisis, city infrastructures, sustainability. So they've got to know how to design and create. They've got to know how to solve multidisciplinary problems. They've got to know how to work in diverse multidisciplinary teams. They've got to understand innovation and business that at the heart of every successful student, of every successful solution, there should be a business case. Somebody has to support it by providing resources, whether it's from the private sector or government or other forms of the public sector, that their work should be imbued with a social consciousness. That is, they should care about the world. So I think that that's what the motivation behind the article was. Now, as you know, at McMaster, in the Faculty of Engineering, we've created a project or an initiative that addresses just that very issue. And that is an ambitious project called the Pivot. Objectives of the Pivot are to take engineering pedagogy and create a very new, reimagined, and redefined educational journey for students that combines complex problem solving, critical thinking, adaptability, and creativity to prepare students for the world of disruption that's going to face us. We need more collisions between the disciplines. We need to create creative forces. We've got to enhance creativity. Because engineering today is much more fully integrated into life than ever before. If you pick up a smartphone, if you're on the web, if you use an app, if you drive an automobile, whether it's an older automobile or if it's one of the new automobiles with semi-autonomous driving, we have to ensure that our students have the capacity to collaborate and thrive in this rapidly changing environment that is producing new technologies in a very, very dynamic manner. So essentially, the goal of the pivot, or the goal of higher education, I think, should be is that every student who graduates is resilient, is a calculated risk taker, who is intellectually curious and unfazed by failure. And to do so, we have to disrupt ourselves and change the direction of our educational approach by really reimagining education as such.
Yeah, so Ishwar, you mentioned this pivot program when we met at the Global Engineering Dean's Council, the industry forum last month. And, you know, it's pretty interesting to hear. I think you were leading a session on skills for the future, and you shared a little bit of what is involved with this program. I guess I'd like to understand a little bit more how hard it was to get everyone on board to really reform the curriculum in this way. And what do you think are the ingredients to making this pivot program a success?
Yeah, good question. So I think that when one reflects back on change, it appears not to be very difficult at all. So I think part of me wants to say, yeah, it was difficult, but, it wasn't that difficult. I'd go back to the essence of leadership. I mean, what do leaders do? It required some leadership from a leadership team. It required some leadership from me. And what a leader must do is a leader must actually present a vision, or a leadership team must present a vision that it buys into. So that was really the first step. And then I think that part of leadership is theatrical. Part of it is using evidence to really present things as they should be. So we went through that whole process, right? I had to establish a sense of urgency. It's very urgent for our graduates to gain the new kinds of skills that they will require in a very disruptive future. I had to form a very powerful coalition, and that coalition required leaders within the Faculty of Engineering at McMaster and across the university, the provost and others who said, wow, this is a good idea, we'll support you. We had to create a vision. What is it that we are trying to do? Why should students undergo this new problem-based learning, experiential learning, community-engaged co-curricular learning educational program? We had to communicate the vision. And to communicate the vision, you've got to use data. You've got to provide evidence. The world is changing. In what direction? What is the employability of graduates now versus what people say their employability will be in the future? What do employers want? What is the big gap in producing innovators or entrepreneurs? So I think communicating the vision had to answer those questions. And then I think one of the major aspects of leadership is empowering others, right? Is to empower others and step back and trust. So if one micromanages, then one owns the project. But if you empower others, step back, and if you're trusting others, the project takes on a deep richness because people provide solutions that you yourself could not have thought about. And, you know, recognize that there are other people who have competencies and knowledge that goes deeper than what you have in very many different ways. We had to plan short-term wins. So by putting the pivot together, it had several small components. One component, for instance, was involving more undergraduate students in research experiences. And that was a short-term win. I had to raise some money for it. I was able to do it. And that was it. And suddenly, we had the highest penetration of undergraduate research in any engineering school in Canada, and one of the highest, I think, in North America and the world. So small wins like that. We had a community-engaged co-curricular learning program, MAC Changers, and that grew, and they provided solutions that our local city, Hamilton, was able to incorporate into some of its planning. So those short-term wins got us a lot of attention. And so people thought that, okay, well, with these short-term wins, if we put a little bit more effort, we'll get the long-term wins. And so then we were able to run various pilots. We ran a pilot on problem-based learning by doing away with the usual sage on the stage, chalk and talk engineering courses for about 150 students. Instead, we gave them one long integrated course where they learned a variety of different things. And that proved to be very successful. So once we took these pilots and short-term wins and we were able to present them, we were able to package everything together into the pivot and create real excitement for transformational change. And so I really do think that the pivot today is not only an exemplar for engineering education, but it is an example of transformative change for many other disciplines in higher education, and that its results can be ported from McMaster to other universities or from engineering education to other disciplines, and particularly professional disciplines.
I'm glad you mentioned the Mac Changers program, because I had read a little bit about that and definitely see that as a great example of how you're trying to your comment earlier, imbue students learning with social consciousness. I guess I wanted to ask you a little bit more about, you know, maybe what you're most excited about. It's obviously an exciting time at McMaster with how you are reforming things, and maybe along a couple industry threads. You know, I know that Siemens and McMaster, we have a long history together, but probably mainly focused in the next generation of automotive engineering talent in the past. I know we've experienced firsthand that talent. We have an intern that began working for us from McMaster a couple years ago, and he's still at Siemens today. And with your background, I know your background in books you published on combustion science and engineering. I think you looked at the environmental implications of combustion. And I think I saw a TEDx talk from you where you talked about cancer stem cell research and interest. So I guess I just, across all those things, what gets you the most excited about the future of engineering education and these future engineers that you're training today? And how do you inspire them with what you're seeing?
You know, what inspires me about the future and excites me about the future is young people. There's a mythology that young people are disengaged, that they are entitled, that somehow they're unable to tackle the hardships that previous generations have tackled. I don't see that. I see young minds that can be excited. I see young minds that are very altruistic. I see young minds that are imbued with a social consciousness and are thirsty to understand how they can contribute to a better world. And so the fundamental thing about higher education is that it's all about students. Sometimes when we immerse ourselves in higher education, we tend to forget that, unfortunately. We start thinking that universities are about research alone or producing good scholarship, or universities are about producing startups, or universities are about giving courses or programs in new and emerging areas. I mean, of course, all of those are very valuable. I participate in all three of those threads. But the fundamental thing about higher education is it's all about students. You've got to care about students, and you've got to care about the student experience. Today's student experience is very different from the student experience 20 years ago or 30 years ago. And the reason is that we live in a very connected world. And that connected world has provided tools and distractions for students. So students today are able to learn in different ways using technology than how I learned or many of my successors learned. So the challenge before us today is how to leverage what students already know in terms of technology, in terms of their learning styles, and provide value to them. That is to have a very profound conversation around teaching and learning. So I'll give you a simple example. One of the major changes that we are making is a move towards experiential learning and problem-based learning. So I'll give you a small example. It's not the only example. The small example is our Engineering One curriculum. Engineering One is the first year engineering curriculum. Today, when students come in this year in September, they will take four discrete courses in materials, in computing, in design, professionalism, and so on and so forth. What they learn in one course is going to be very different from what they learn in another course. Why do we do this? We do this because about a century or so ago, the Carnegie Foundation evaluated education across North America. And the Carnegie Foundation then came up with this idea or conception of a Carnegie unit. And through discussion, there appeared to be general consensus that, well, university learning or college learning was really equivalent in a course to about 3 Carnegie units. And those 3 Carnegie units are what we call credit hours today, 3 credit hours. But we don't have to fractionate the curriculum into 3 credit hours of this and 3 credit hours of that. Because let us say if I use math, some of the math is used in materials curriculum. And if I look at computing, some of the computing is used in the materials curriculum. If you go back to Bloom's taxonomy, and if you go back to really the concept of teaching and learning, if you go back to the educational concepts of Piaget, Vygotsky, the whole idea of schema, how we build conceptions about the world. So all of us view the world in a particular way. When we learn how to address a subject in a particular way. And when we are together, our learning differs a little bit because we've created schemas of the world, right? So essentially now we are creating schemas through bite-sized 3 credit hour courses. But if in real life, if I have a problem, let's say my garage door opener breaks, well, it's an electrical problem, it's a mechanical problem, you know, I'm going to have to know something about the garage door opener. And if at the very least, if nothing works, I'm going to have to take that old contraption off and rewire it and rejig it and put it back again, either new or refurbished. So this requires different competencies. And so what we're doing in the first year curriculum from fall of next year is we are collapsing those 4 courses together into one 13 credit hour course that begins in September, ends at the end of April. And it will have essentially 5 projects. Well, 4 long projects and 1 very short introductory project. And students will work just as they're supposed to work in the real workplace. We'll randomly assign students to teams. We'll address diversity, make sure there's a critical mass of women and men. So in a team of 5, you just don't want 1 woman alone. Because research has shown that...
No, we want 4 women.
That's right. research, well, good news there. So this year, the incoming class at McMaster Engineering, we'll have close to 1,000 students, will be approximately 35% women. Not half bad. What I'm saying is research has shown over and over again that 30% is a critical fraction if you want a constituency heard, whether it's students from a particular demographic or of a particular gender. So we are going to create real-world teams randomly, and they will then address these projects. Once the project is over, they'll be assessed both by instructors, by TAs, there'll be peer evaluations, and then they'll move on to a second project where, again, the teams will be sort of mixed up. These will be teams of 4. And that's what happens in the real world. You know, people are put together for teams. So through that project-based learning, they're going to learn about all the disciplines that we are trying to cover. And through that, we'll create a sense of spiraling. So it'll be a spiral curriculum. What you learn about one thing will spiral through a project that involves another subject. And so through that spiral learning and the hands-on, minds-on approach, you use it, so you're not going to lose it. The students will then learn. What's the point? The point is that if there's learning that's abstract, it produces what I call perishable skills. You don't use complex algebra or complex calculus. If you don't use integral differential equations, you're going to forget how to use them. But we can give students or impart to students durable skills. And those durable skills are the ones that they get through a spiral curriculum that has hands-on and minds-on learning. It's enhancing the learning of students that excites me, because we are producing the graduates of the future who are going to solve the wicked problems that our world faces. Climate change, the opioid crisis, as I mentioned, just wicked, wicked problems that don't seem to have a solution today, because ultimately what we want in the world is harmony and peace, and peace and harmony are going to come when people put their minds together to solve problems that really make a difference to humankind.
That's really exciting. And I can see why you've got so many people on board with the powerful change you're making in engineering education there. Your passion speaks very loud and clearly. I guess I would ask you, Ishwar, while I know we've worked together, our organizations, maybe it's been more in the experiential learning with programs like EcoCar. I guess I'd like to understand from your perspective how industry or how a company like Siemens can help schools more. Where do we fit in that spiral for you? And what more do you need from software companies like ourselves?
So various levels of engagement, right? I can think of a few right off the bat. The first level of engagement is stay involved and provide advice. But provide advice that is universal and not just specific to that company's needs. The disconnect here could be is that in higher education, we produce graduates who should be employable and productive for 3 or 4 decades. Whereas sometimes industrial needs are much more urgent in the 1 to 3 year time frame. So making us understand how we can align the shorter time frame with the longer time frame, the graduate's interest with the company's interest, would be an excellent start. To do that, for instance, I have a Dean's Advisory Board where I have members, most of whom serve in C-suites of various corporations at the CTO rank, CEO rank, and so on and so forth. And they provide exactly that kind of advice. The second is get engaged with our students. You mentioned EcoCar. That's an outstanding example. The EcoCar team at McMaster runs like a small company. And essentially, the team will divide into various groups. It'll have somebody who's a leader, somebody like a CEO. It'll have other individuals who'll be, again, leaders akin to, let's say, vice presidents. Then it'll have teams who would be akin to directors or managers. So they would have a controls team. They would have an electrical propulsion team. They would have a marketing team. They would have a sponsorship team, a fundraising team, and so on. And so what this does is it mimics a real world experience. In doing so, our students, those teams that are sub-teams in the overall EcoCar team, they interact with industry folks who provide technical guidance, administrative guidance, guidance about how to organize, how to market, how to meet certain challenges. So they get mentored by industry. The third way I would say is that one of the most important components of the pivot at McMaster is work-integrated learning, which is another form of experiential learning. So providing internship and co-op opportunities for our students is, again, a valuable service. What we found is that a very large number of our students, when they perform satisfactorily in co-ops in industry, that gives them a leg in. They're actually recruited by those corporations for work. So it's a way for industry to identify talent before the fact so that the industry risk is diluted, and a way for students to become professionalized. Now, not every student who's offered an opportunity in a particular company will take it because they might choose to go to a competitor. But the benefit to the student is that they gain professional skills. The benefit to companies is that they largely de-risk, talent acquisition. The other ways are working with our students and our faculty members on projects. These are design projects that are real-world problems, that have real-world clients, which in this case are the companies, that require real-world solutions. Now, some of them may be large. They may be research projects. But we think of research projects also as a very profound way of teaching and learning. The object of much of the research that we do is not only to create solutions, but to train and educate undergraduate, graduate students, postdoctoral fellows, and also faculty members, by the way, how to create authentic solutions that have application in the real world. So There's a variety of ways, advising certainly, mentoring students, offering experiential learning opportunities, getting engaged, getting to know the university and vice versa, so that together we can try and solve these very real world problems that do require solutions. And, you know, what are those real world problems in an industry context? You know, autonomous driving is one real world problem, smart grid, energy solutions, integrating renewable energy with a grid that also relies on other forms of energy. I mean, that's a real world problem. So there are many, many real world problems, medical devices, how to image properly using an MRI, developing better and better machine learning algorithms to identify tumors, diagnose other kinds of structures and diseases. That's another problem. So I think that there is a very rich space in which universities and industry can collaborate and benefit from each other for the benefit of the future employees of that corporation, for the benefit of graduates of a university, and also because it creates a new agility within the university. The university itself, by experiencing these collaborations, becomes more agile. And if for nothing else, just for that. Why? Because the agile university of tomorrow will be the competitive university of tomorrow. It will be the reputable university of tomorrow. If a university is not agile, it will not be reputable. And in academia, Dora, as you know, reputation is everything. It takes years to build and you can lose it in an instant.
Well, I think you are doing all the right things to build a future for a very strong reputation at McMaster. And I think that makes it a great place. It's going to be the backdrop, right, for the Global Engineering Dean's Council next year.
That is correct. So we will host the Global Engineering Dean's Council Industry Forum to talk about exactly these kinds of issues. Issues about engineering education that has a purpose and real impact on society, how we can introduce these competencies of designing creativity, multidisciplinary approaches, multiculturalism, social consciousness, innovation in each and every graduate who graduates. There are very many different pathways to achieve this. And I think that fora like that, and Dora, you've been a strong supporter of the industry forum. When people from academia, industry, the government, and other organizations in the public sector, including student organizations, come together, we can really create rich global solutions by learning from each other. The future really needs that, because the future is going to be disruptive. And if we're going to be able to address that disruption in an organized manner, it behooves us to start, you know, today, this very instant.
Well, I look forward to that. I think it's going to be a great event. I know coming out of this last one, it was a tremendous amount of really actionable insights, which can often be rare at some conferences. So definitely look forward to that. You know, I want to come back as we close this podcast out to in the beginning when we talked about that article you wrote for Globe and Mail. One of the things you said in there towards the end was a great Canadian sage once spoke of the need to skate to where the puck is going to be. The puck in business and society is moving toward human flexibility and interdisciplinary approaches. This is where the Canadian university is uniquely placed to deliver meaning and value if it can create its own self-disruption. And so I'd like to end on saying, Ishwar, I don't think there was anything accidental about your engineering journey. And we thank your mom for giving you that gentle push into it, because you are doing great things that we would love to see scale at so many academic institutions. So thank you for taking the time today to share a little bit of your journey and what's happening at McMaster. And we look forward to working with you in the future.
Thank you very much, Dora. It's been an absolute pleasure. I look forward to meeting you again, and I look forward to talking again anytime.
Thank you, Ishwar.
Thank you.